ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
A demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today on Big Ideas, how pop culture turned a generation of women against themselves. Natasha Mitchell taking you right back to the late 1990s and the early aughts into a world of heroin chic and, yes, girl power.
And so the pairing of these two words as a slogan, yes, it was about, you know, power to girls and women, but it was also about why don't these words go together? Why do we not associate women and girls with power? Why? It was, you know, a slogan that was really intended to make people think. And then the Spice Girls came along, obviously co-opted this slogan, took it for themselves, made it hugely famous. But in doing so, it had lost all its activist intention, I think, and all of its kind of prickly energy, and it was much more celebratory in the way that post-feminism as a reaction to third wave feminism was much more about like, don't worry, you can, it's not necessary, like feminism is not necessary anymore, women have made all this progress, you can wear whatever you want, you can sleep with whoever you want, you know, you can, you're free, go out and spend money and have fun. And it was an intoxicating message, I think, because it was, you didn't have to do anything. Like, you didn't have to fight. You didn't have to go to meetings. You didn't have to do zines. You could just, you know, go out and buy lip gloss. And the Spice Girls had £500 million worth of branding deals in their first year and a half as a band.
So this is a time before social media had landed to warp our sense of self, right? But another force was well at work, hell-bent on exploiting feminism for profit. And millennials were the target market. The impacts were often brutal. Sophie Gilbert knows firsthand what the move from Madonna and the Riot Girls to Britney Spears, the Kardashians and Kate Moss meant for her generation. The award-winning culture critic at The Atlantic and Pulitzer Prize-nominated writer investigates the impact in her book Girl on Girl. She's also author of On Womanhood, Bodies, Literature and Choice. And we're joining Sophie on stage at the Wheeler Centre in Naarm, Melbourne, with writer, critic and senior programmer at the Melbourne International Film Festival, Kate Jinks.
Please welcome Sophie. Tonight we're going to delve into the book. You were living in New York at the time. You're a young parent. I don't want to re-traumatise you.
It's okay.
There were COVID lockdowns, all of that. And it's interesting that your deep thinking on the early aughts really coincided with a time when nostalgia for that era was super heightened, just from millennials who were kind of fantasizing about their youth, but also teenagers rediscovering the disgusting fashions of the time. And I just wanted to know, that was that nostalgic spotlight on the Y2K era and the couple of decades beyond that you go into, did that cause you to want to take a deeper critical look, or was there kind of a lightning rod moment for you to go into this area of research?
I don't think it was a reaction to nostalgia. I completely understand the nostalgia. I think for one thing, like, I think about the fashion now and the like pink sparkly everything and the Diamante like razor phones, and it was such a flashy kind of bedazzled decade. And I feel like with nostalgia, there's kind of a two-decade cycle where we just come back to things. And if you haven't lived through them before, it's thrilling. Not the low-cut jeans. I don't want the low-cut jeans back, but I don't get to choose. I think it was more, a confluence of things. Roe v. Wade was overturned in the US in 2022. And I had just had twins in this moment of real isolation, which had me thinking a lot about identity and how we form, like, because in the transition into parenthood, you sort of lose sight of yourself. So I was thinking a lot about identity and about how culture shapes us. And also when Roe was overturned, I just felt so angry and so powerless. And I couldn't understand what had happened to the momentum of feminism and of not even feminism as a practice, as a movement, but just in terms of women believing that things would always get better for us, that seemed to have gone away. And people were passing the politics of what had happened. But to me, culture has always been really crucial in terms of understanding the things we dream about, our ambitions, what we want, how we shape our lives. And so I did just really want to go back to this decade to try and learn a bit more about what it was telling all of us in that moment and the impact that might have had, you know, two decades down the line.
Mm. When you think about the kind of nostalgic aspect of it, do you kind of look at people's nostalgia now for that era and go, oh, it's not what it was all cracked up to be?
I mean, I try to say that the book is in no judgment zone because I don't want to, I don't know, like, I don't want to cancel anyone's joy ever. And if reality TV brings you joy, if expensive face products bring you joy, they do me.
And the housewives do me.
The housewives do you, yeah. I mean, joy is hard to find in this life, and life is hard, and I really don't want to take away anything that anyone loves. It was more about wanting to find a framework with which I could help myself and hopefully other people just understand the dynamics of this decade, understand what it had been saying to girls, to women, really holistically throughout every form of media, as I found out when I went back to do the research, like what it does to you to be told from really your teenage years onwards that sex is power. It's the ultimate form of power you'll have. It's the only kind of power that you'll ever need. It's the only thing you should aspire to, and it's the only thing that matters, like what that does to your head. And so sort of reckon with that in my own thinking a bit, but then also to really, I end up coming in the book back to this year of 2007, which was this really critical year when everywhere you look, famous women were falling apart, having breakdowns in the public eye. I mean, Britney shaving her head, Anna Nicole Smith overdosing, Paris going to jail, Lindsay going to rehab. It was just this nonstop TikTok rolling chaos of beautiful, famous women suffering in public. And at the same time, it was also the year that Hillary Clinton announced she was running for president. And I was interested in the conflict between those two things. Like, what were we being told about what women were capable of, and how are we supposed to, in our most subconscious minds, believe that women are capable of great power and great opportunity, no, but of holding these fundamental roles when so much of our culture is obsessed with showing us women not living up to those standards.
Mm. You don't appear yourself too much in the book, which perhaps we'll get to in conversation. I did really love when you do appear at the same bar as Amy Winehouse, though. But when you were researching this period, did you feel at all kind of self-critical about the time, or like how you did or did not participate in the culture of the time?
I did before the book. One of the questions I had going in was, I remembered where I was the day Britney shaved her head. I was working in a restaurant in London, and I remembered my manager kind of coming to get me, being like, come watch, like she's shaving her head. And we were like, what? Like it was entertainment instead of a woman's profound mental health crisis where she was being stalked by photographers and like clearly suffering. And she'd had two kids before she was 25. She was about to lose custody of her kids. She was embroiled in a very messy separation. She was being followed every second of every day by packs of men on scooters who would yell all kinds of things at her. And none of that was clear in the moment, in the way that it should have been, in the way that it is now. And I wanted to know why I had been so callous in my experience of that moment, but why we'd all been encouraged to, why, I mean, I'm sure people here remember that the tenor of the internet in the 2000s was very cruel, very, very performatively cruel. And sort of wanting to understand where that came from and why we all were socialized into participating in it, I think was a big part of wanting to figure things out. But the weird thing is, as I did more and more research, I did have a lot of shame about the way that I'd lived during this era. And then understanding more about just how much we were bombarded with really toxic messaging day out, I'm sort of amazed now that we all survived, because we got out, and it was such a dark period for young women to live through, and having come out determined not to do the same things over and over again, I think I've let go of a lot of that shame, and I actually feel a lot more relieved, I think.
Yeah. I'm a couple of years older than you, but we've had sort of a fairly similar background in a pop culture kind of setting, having read your book. But my teenage years were very heavily influenced by Riot Girl culture. I was very involved. And then, like, so-called alternative culture, which seems like such a naive thing to say, that term. But I turned 20 in the year 2000, and even though I worked in like fashion magazines and culture magazines in the early aughts, I think I blocked most of that decade out. And then when I reread, when I was reading your book, I feel like I disassociated from it largely by how truly bleak the cultural landscape was. In part of the book, you write, "What I remember from this period was how little counter-programming there was." And I wanted to know, like, why do you think this was? Like, because the 90s was sort of full of this idea of, and not to look too kind of naively at the 90s also, mm-hmm. or even Riot Girl as a movement, also alternative culture, lol. But, yeah, what do you think, like, the big change was?
I think it was a moment of real backlash. And I think this moment that we did have in the early 90s that was so activist and ferocious and full of like really impassioned, energetic activism on behalf of women and honesty, like people making music about sexual assault and abuse and the conditions that women were living under in that time. And it was so thrilling, but there was a real backlash to it. And it wasn't so much a sort of fight, I think, as it was just the silencing of a certain strands of culture. I'm thinking about how the supermodels of the early 90s, like the Cindy Crawfords and Christy Turlington, Naomi Campbell, they were all really strong as a unit. They were a collective. They were enormously well paid. They were great friends. You know, Christy would say, "I'm not going to do this show if you don't also book Naomi." And they were very strong and powerful and influential and famous, and they got paid so much money. And the designers got sick of them because they were so expensive, and the designers felt like the models were overshadowing the clothes and they wanted the focus back on the clothes. So that was when you started to see the edging out of this movement of very strong, beautiful, like very like healthy and powerful looking women. And you see the ushering in of a new aesthetic of much skinnier, much younger, much frailer models, you know, the waves, the heroin chics, the Kate Mosses, these teenagers who, you know, in some photographs gorgeously in so many ways, but also were much younger, were much frailer, couldn't push back, didn't know what their boundaries were. They were much easier to manipulate and to coerce. And I think that, as an example, speaks to how backlash played out throughout the decade and how you did just see any time a woman had power and had agency, she was kind of shunted aside for a new wave of teenagers. And you certainly see it in music, in the shift from Riot Girl through the Spice Girls to Britney and Christina and this kind of teen pop era that was obsessed with like sparkly teenage pop stars.
Mm, yeah. And then I think, you know, by bringing up Kate Moss and the models that followed her, we kind of got into a period of like the everyday girl who's going to be like in an American Apparel ad. And, mm-hmm. you know, like it got worse and worse from there. I do want to go back to the Spice Girls and Riot Girl and the differences between the Riot Girl girl power and the Spice Girls girl power, and absolutely love the Spice Girls, just need to
Same.
Say.
Mm-hmm.
But you do say about like the Spice Girls kind of message, or the message that was put onto them, that with girl power, that essentially feminism, you say, "Feminism was over. Having achieved all it needed to, women were free to dress and adorn themselves however they wanted. Any individual choice could be empowering if someone declared it to be so. Consumerism was the path to self-fulfillment," which I loved. Do you think it's just like an incredibly fine line between like empowerment and freedom for women?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it feels now a little bit like the origin of what we call choice feminism. But I don't think it was that intentional. And I think a lot of what the Spice Girls were doing was very pure. But it was really poisoned by money, I think. So to go back, the slogan Girl Power was a Riot Girl slogan. It was initially coined by two members of the band Bikini Kill. They were working on a zine one afternoon, I think, and they were looking for two words that didn't go together. And the drummer, Toby Vell, I think, said to Kathleen Hanna, like, what's a word that doesn't go with girl? And Kathleen said, power. And so the pairing of these two words as a slogan, yes, it was about, you know, power to girls and women, but it was also about, why don't these words go together? Why do we not associate women and girls with power? Why? It was, you know, a slogan that was really intended to make people think. And then the Spice Girls came along, obviously co-opted this slogan, took it for themselves, made it hugely famous. But in doing so, it had lost all its activist intention, I think, and all of its kind of prickly energy. And it was much more celebratory in the way that post-feminism as a reaction to third wave feminism was much more about like, don't worry, you can, it's not necessary, like feminism is not necessary anymore. Women have made all this progress. You can wear whatever you want. You can sleep with whoever you want. You know, you can, you're free, go out and spend money and have fun. And it was an intoxicating message, I think, because it was, you didn't have to do anything. Like, you didn't have to fight. You didn't have to go to meetings. You didn't have to do zines. You could just, you know, go out and buy lip gloss. And but literally, like, the Spice Girls had £500 million worth of branding deals in their first year and a half as a band. They had Spice Girls body spray, Spice Girls trainers, Spice Girl Polaroid cameras. Like, whatever you wanted to buy, you could buy a Spice Girls version of it. And once people saw how much money could be made by putting pop stars on things, it was really the end of the road, I think, for people being interested in women and their angry rock about abortions. It was much more like, oh, here's a shiny pop star and she'll sell lip gloss to teenage girls and that will make us money. And so that was really explaining, I think, what happened after.
The author of Girl on Girl, How Pop Culture Turned a Generation of Women Against Themselves, Sophie Gilbert, culture critic and staff writer at The Atlantic, on Big Ideas Today on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, with me, Natasha Mitchell. Back to film curator and writer Kate Jinks, who's asking the questions today about the decade that Sophie Gilbert interrogated. It's a decade when the millennial women were coming of age in a world of girl power-driven profits.
And while we're on the kind of co-option of, you know, feminist terms, you do mention, can't remember the date now, but when, you know, Beyoncé performed in front of the word feminist, and it felt like the word feminist was really back and it had meaning, and then very quickly it sort of became a brand opportunity again, and, you know, like Acne were making scarves that said radical feminist, and Dior were making those t-shirts that said something about feminism.
Yeah, and like, you know, Future is Female, all that stuff. But
that's different because the money did go to Planned Parenthood. But with, like, the Dior slogan that costs, like, you know, hundreds of dollars, I mean, did you just feel that this was, like, this was the cycle returning again, that this is just sort of has become a branding opportunity, something to get behind that you don't necessarily believe in, but you see that there's, like, feminist dollar there?
Yeah, it did. I think in the book I call it tote bag feminism, because it just felt like it was the buzzword. I mean, now I miss it. I'm like, can we have the buzzword moment back, please? Like, because now I feel like you never hear the word feminism at all. It's almost like a dirty word. People don't want to, I don't know how the concept somehow is always weaponized to the extent where it becomes cringe by its detractors. But no, it was this moment where I think partly it was the confluence of that feminist moment in pop culture, but also Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, and the ways in which I think Lean In has been revealed to be not what it seemed, or certainly, I mean, many people were writing when Lean In was published about how it was a very individualistic model for women that was not interested in the kind of collective action that really is the only way that we ever improve conditions materially for women in society. But yeah, a lot of things that turned out to be disappointing in the end, I think. And that, and for some reason, has sort of poisoned the term in our minds. And I don't know how we reclaim it, but I hope we can.
Yeah. Do you think it's partly to do with the rise of the term post-feminism, that it becomes this kind of like post-truth world? Like, the first time I heard post-feminism, I thought, how dare you? It's, you know, we're we're still living in a in a time of feminism. We still need feminism. Do you think that that has something to do with, or like a lack of kind of, I don't know, like a figurehead, or I don't know.
I really don't know. It feels like in some ways, quietly, women are making progress every day in their lives and culture, but we are seeing these methodical losses of power and of rights and of status in different ways, and the rise of the manosphere, and it's really overt misogyny. And I feel like there is so much that needs to be, like, there is so much need for a movement that can respond to all of these things, but there's just no one obvious figurehead right now, and I don't know who it would be. And yet, you know, going out and doing all these events, there is such a kind of hunger for, like, not collective action, but movements of women, again, almost like consciousness-raising seminars, to bring back the 70s. But every time...
I mean, please do.
Yeah, no, I'd love it. I mean, we're all here tonight. But every time you're in a room with other women, like, there's so much that's different in the discourse than there is when you're online. There's just a real energy. It's so much easier to listen and to communicate and to respect each other when we're all in person, when we're not kind of talking on our phones.
Yeah. I think there's so much in kind of contemporary feminism, this when you're writing about sort of sex or violence or porn, which you write about a lot in this book, there's kind of been a lot of hand-wringing, you know, that one wants to distance themselves from kind of a pearl-clutching ideal of feminism, or a, like a second-wave feminism, or the idea that you're a prude. It, you know, you used to see people putting in their Twitter bios things like man-loving feminist. Like, I'm not, you know, one of those.
Cool.
Yeah, cool. But now I feel like it's more about, it's sort of saying, it's not for the male opinion of feminism, it's saying to other women, like, I'm not judging you, don't worry. Was that something that you were really thinking about when you were writing this, like how to protect your kind of journalistic inquiries, but also remaining true to you, your own beliefs, and like what also brings you pleasure? Like, was that sort of a something that was kind of front of mind at all?
I think it's the constant tension when you are writing critically about anything, to know that it is, people will have different opinions from you, and that might make them disagree, and that might even make them angry. But you have to keep going down the line of inquiry, because that's the thing that matters. I'm thinking about, like, porn, obviously, it's a very tricky subject, because in some ways, like, we have always wanted to see sexual imagery, and we always will. There are cave paintings of giant phalluses. You know, there are, like, lithographs, like, very dirty lithographs from the 17th century. There's any time we've been able to have technology to make images, we've used it to make images of sex. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. At the same time, the kind of porn that we have predominantly been given to watch has been porn that really reifies, I think, male power and female submission. And certainly, not always, but I would say that's generally the power dynamic. And also, just the idea, it really has presented the idea to women over the last few decades, I think, that male pleasure is paramount, and women, the purpose of women during sex is to sort of gratify that pleasure and to perform sexuality in a way that is pleasing to men. And so I did want to be able to unpack those power dynamics without being critical of the entirety of porn. And it's a hard needle to thread. I've had responses to the book saying it's too pro-porn, and I've had responses saying it's too anti-porn. And in some ways, I feel like that emphasizes that I'm right where I want to be, which is everywhere and nowhere.
Porn does take up quite a chunk of the research in your book, and I was surprised by how much it is the backdrop to basically everything, every topic in the book, all of our media, our cultural imaging. Did that surprise you too in your research, that it just kept cropping up?
Yeah, I was naive. I didn't think it would be as big a piece of the book as it ended up being. I knew early on that the title would be Girl on Girl, and I liked the way that it seemed to get at subjects I was interested in, unwinding conflict between women, the way that we're sort of weaponized against ourselves and taught to really hate ourselves in so many ways so that we buy things and are good consumers. And I was interested also in the state of girlhood and how it's one that in so many ways it's hard for us to ever kind of get out of. But I didn't think that porn would be as big as it was. And yet now that feels incredibly stupid because, of course, it was the dominant art form really of the 21st century. It was one that probably more people consume than any other. And there was just such a massive rise in the number of people watching it that you can't have anything be exposed to that many people worldwide and not have it influence the culture. I mean, culture is the product of all of our kind of shared imaginations and our shared sense of self and sense of other people, our sort of anthropological impulses. And so, of course, in this moment when porn is becoming incredibly popular, there are not enough words to describe how big, I would say explosive, but it sounds like very dubious in the context of porn, like explosive rise in pornography. A statistic I think is from the mid 1980s, there were 70 million pornographic VHS rentals in the US. And by the mid 1990s, it was 700 million. So a tenfold increase in the number of people watching porn. And that was pre-internet. Mm. And then
this
suddenly.
Was back when you had to get it from behind a beaded curtain.
Behind the curtain,
store.
Yeah. They all had like quite quaint names. But no, then the internet comes along and suddenly it's so much bigger by scale. So yeah, of course. But not what I was expecting at all.
Mm. I really appreciate in your writing about sexual violence in narrative film, which you kind of work into your chapter that is largely about pornography, that you included work by female directors. And you can argue that these directors are kind of interrogating the culture through a different framework, a different lens. And many of the films that you mentioned are my favourite films. But when you write about porn, your focus here is really rightly on the kind of output of heteronormative, misogynistic, kind of male-run studios. Did you look at all at the kind of women-led porn? Like there's, you know, a huge rise in women making porn and starting their own studios. There always has been, obviously, in queer culture, but now it's more kind of mainstream and straight as well. Do you think that that was such a big thing in the kind of the period of your research, or is that kind of a fresher advance?
When I think about people like the filmmaker Erica Lust, who is a feminist porn director who tries very hard to make pornography that is sort of centered around the idea of female pleasure and female power and agency, and she treats all her actors very well, and she's sort of very ethical in the making of her movies. I think she's relatively recent as a phenomenon, and there certainly have been people who make ethical porn, but when you look at the, it's a drop in the ocean compared with what most people have been watching, what most people are served. And like when you log onto Pornhub as a new user, I think within, you know, 75% of the videos you'll get before you've given them a sense of you is that contains some kind of violence. So it was important for me to be as generalist as possible in that chapter, just to communicate the scale of what so many people are seeing.
Yeah, it's frightening.
Yeah,
reading it. It can be a grim world.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I really appreciated that you went there, and it was, yeah, I think a lot of people's eyes will be opened to that, hopefully. But yeah, was there kind of a self-care regime going on while you were researching that section of the book?
No, I didn't sleep very well. There's one chapter of the book, chapter six. It is very dark. And it wasn't, I think, supposed to be, but it was, I knew I wanted to write about the art house directors of the 2000s, the people who were making, they were behind a movement that was named the New French Extremity, so people like Catherine Breillat, who were really interested in interrogating in this like very nihilist French way, so it's like very bleak, why sex and power had not been liberating for women and why things were still so messy and so fraught. And a lot of really artistic filmmakers in the 2000s were experimenting with whether or not they could put real sex on camera, like real explicit sex, and have it be anything other than porn. So it was kind of an interesting philosophical experiment, I think, in lots of ways. But then also that chapter deals with the rise of, say, torture porn movies like Hostel and this new kind of extreme violence on screen that very much seemed to be feeding off a shift towards extremity in the porn industry as well as the violence of the Iraq war and post 9/11. There was a lot going on, I think, in the generalized subconscious during that time that felt like it was important to try to draw out, even though it is not always easy reading.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and you do make the connection of, like, the producer of Hostel was also the producer on The Bachelor.
Yeah, Mike Fleiss.
And now we're in the Bridgerton era, less sadistic perhaps, but is it any better for women in its portrayal of women? Natasha Mitchell bringing you Big Ideas, coming to you from the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne today with Kate Jinks in conversation with The Atlantic's Sophie Gilbert, who is author of Girl on Girl, How Pop Culture Turned a Generation of Women Against Themselves. Back to Kate.
So, which brings us to reality TV.
Yeah.
Often I find when you see kind of a sort of a misogynistic television show or some kind of anything, you know, there are people who say, oh, a man must have made this. Mm-hmm. But then in reading your chapter about reality TV, I was quite naively, you know, shocked to find that so many women were behind some of the most abject shows available. Like, I don't even have a word for this show, but The Swan.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if anyone has seen, but it's essentially it's a race to the bottom. It's a race to get as much cosmetic surgery, and the contestants were hidden from mirrors throughout their cosmetic journeys. But, yeah, I just wanted you to talk a little bit about your kind of views on reality TV. Do you have, like, are there reality TV shows that you were drawn to, but then, like, a show like that, I'm going to out my partner as loving that show, and I was always, The Swan, she was always sending me clips from it, and I was like, how can you watch this? But then I'm watching every episode of, you know, Housewives, what's the difference? But, yeah, what's your kind of take on reality television? Is it something that you consume at all as a kind of viewer, or is it much more a kind of anthropological, kind of a critical propulsion for you?
I don't watch a lot of it now. I did watch a lot of it during the 2000s, and I revisited a lot for the book. I loved the chapter on reality TV the most, I think, because it was this moment of a real shift in terms of visibility and how visibility for women became a currency that could, you know, if you were willing to expose yourself enough, like the depths of your life, put yourself on a reality show, like set up a webcam in your apartment, you could gain money, power, influence. And that, I think, set the model for so many of the ways in which we live now. And so kind of getting into the early iterations of that and understanding how they functioned, it helped me understand a lot about, you know, the way that I Instagram, but also the just the power dynamics of visibility and why it's been so ingrained in us that this is something very valuable for us as women that we need to constantly explore in our own lives. And I was really fascinated in the shifts, I guess, between what shows were trying to do, because I remembered so well when Big Brother debuted in the UK. I think it was in the year, either 1999 or 2000. And it was very much this kind of social experiment. It was curious about human nature. It was like, what would happen if you put all these people in a house together and, you know, put them under stressful conditions? How will they interact? It seemed like it was a kind of, yes, a bit of a prurient endeavor, but at the same time, it did have this real curiosity about human nature that I found more worthy than a lot of what came after. But I think what happened, I mean, I talk about the pattern of, like, money poisoning everything. Once people realized how cheap it was to make reality TV, I mean, my God, there was like a gold rush. And because there were suddenly so many shows being made, they had to compete for ratings. And the easiest way to do that was to put the most really disgusting things on air that people could dream up. So there was a show, it was actually a precursor to The Bachelor, but it was called How to Marry a Multimillionaire. And they had 50 American women compete pageant style in Vegas to marry a man who none of them had ever met. And so I think there was like a swimsuit portion. And they were all, I mean, you can see in the final round, like, the reality of it dawn on them, what they've signed up for, that they will have to actually, but it really was like a cattle call of women. And And it really, I can think, entrenched these kind of like Jane Austen marital dynamics where it's like, you don't need to know anything about this man, just know that he's rich. Like, that's all you need to marry him. And then it turned out that the groom had had a restraining order placed against him by an ex because he'd been accused of domestic violence. So that marriage was quickly annulled. But shows like that, and The Swan, they took 12 women, they left, you know, made them leave their families, go live in this house where there were no mirrors. They had dozens of surgeries. They were put in extreme diets. They went to the gym. And then they would be revealed in this final episode where they would see themselves in the mirror so unrecognizable that their own children sometimes didn't know who they were. And there was no psychological aftercare, or like it was just sort of this shock tactic of seeing people completely changed. And there was no sense, I think, that that might be really fundamentally destabilizing for someone to go into a house looking one way and then come out looking another. But they were also made to compete in the end. So it was like, no matter what they'd done, the surgeries they'd gone through, the pain that they'd endured, one of them was still the winner and the others were deemed not beautiful enough. So, I mean, yeah, all these shows that were really interested in, I think, getting into our worst impulses as viewers and our worst curiosities, and had no ethics at all and no qualms about putting anything on television.
Yeah. And you discuss, you know, the rise of kind of cam culture in the book as well, and the kind of, it's essentially like a flattening of reality TV, and it's sort of the idea of it's sort of empowering because you can control it, but you're not really controlling who is watching, etc. With The Swan, though, I was astounded to learn that the creator of it came up with the idea after she'd had children and took herself to what she calls, well, you call in the book, like a fat camp, mm-hmm. like a wellness retreat of sorts that sounds, you know, a little more violent than that. And she thought, wouldn't it be great if I could go through all of this kind of wellness stuff, but then also get my breasts done,
mm-hmm.
And then came up with a show. It's kind of frightening, and I think it brings us back to the title of kind of Girl on Girl, which is a naughty reference, a joke, but also this very much this idea of women, I don't know, like leading into their own demise, which is something I've sort of, as a, you know, pretty staunch feminist from very early on, is something I've never wanted to really consider too much. But is that, what's your kind of take on that and your research into it?
I think we are taught very, very early on to find fault with ourselves in so many different ways that it becomes a kind of, it's a voice that you don't even know is there, and you certainly don't know that it's not a part of you, that it's a voice that you've learned. The voice that is always like, oh, you need to lose 5 pounds, or you need to, you know, get your hair done, or you need to do your eyebrows or shave your legs. Like the voice that is always telling you that you're failing at the project of self-maintenance. And I don't fault people for having that voice, because how can you not? Like, we're bombarded with imagery, especially now with phones. Like, every time I go on Instagram, I get deep plane facelift content, mm-hmm. trying to really get me to have a deep plane. It's not going to happen because I'm way too squeamish. but just the constant messaging telling you that if you just spend, there's a John Berger quote. John Berger was an art critic who wrote a book in the 70s called Ways of Seeing. And there's so many quotes, but there's one in the book, I had to choose one. And it talks about how advertising steals the love of the woman as she is and sells it back to her for the price of the product. And I think that's so much of what all of this is about. Like, the kind of culture that we have steals our ability to love ourselves as we are, because it wants to sell us products so that we can get some of that love back. And so, yeah, in some ways that woman, Nellie Galland, the producer of The Swan, thinking that the most important thing she needed to do after having a kid was get her body back. It doesn't surprise me at all.
I was reading Miranda July's newsletter, which came out this morning, and she's like taking her kid to see one battle after another. The kid hated it. Miranda loved it. But when the kid wanted to leave, she says, kids these days say I love you to each other and don't say why they should have to watch something so violent made by a man. And what can I say? I'm just really used to it. And I felt that was like a quite a good summary of like so much that is in the book, that, you know, even looking back on all of the kind of violence and like the Terry Richardson of it all, you know, you look back and you think, God, I'm just so used to this constant barrage of you know, like misogynistic imagery and violence, and you just get so, I don't know, weighted down. Did you feel kind of tired by all of this, by researching this, or were you kind of, did it, I don't know, ignite something and a fire within you to...
Both. No, I mean, it's a lot to go back. I think when you're living through a moment, it's very hard to see it clearly. Like, we can't see the time that we're in right now clearly. There's so much happening. It's so diffuse. It's very hard to see the connections and the, you know, the power dynamics. When you go back and you look at a decade as sort of intensively as I really tried to with this one, and not just the decade, but also the preceding decade and what happened with AIDS and like the influence of all these things that were great moments of international trauma, you do realize, I don't know, you sort of see the framework, I think, in a different way. And so, yeah, it is a lot, but I think the only way that we will ever be able to draw out some of the internalized misogyny is to realize that it does not come from us. Like, it does not, we were not born with it, we learned it, and that means we can unlearn it anytime we are brave enough.
I love it. That's what we need right now, absolutely. You mentioned the AIDS crisis just then, and it's something I wanted to touch on. The AIDS crisis appears in your book far more than I ever thought it would. I'm a gay woman. I have mostly thought of the AIDS crisis in terms of how it affected queer communities and a lot of queer men in particular, and our culture and our history and what we lost. But my eyes were really opened by your writing and how it affected kind of a more mainstream pop culture. I'd never really thought about that. How you see the AIDS crisis affecting kind of pop culture and like women at large?
Yeah, culture is always really interesting for ways that it, in ways that I think aren't even intentional, the ways that it reflects our most profound anxieties in any given moment. And so with something like the AIDS crisis, it came right after this decade where finally, I think, people had felt liberated sexually. Like, there was a real movement to destigmatize sex, to remove shame from sex, to sort of encourage people to think about sex as something that could be about pleasure and joy instead of fear and shame and pregnancy and, like, all the worst parts that have been attached to it. And then AIDS came along, and I think it was just this moment of profound terror culturally, terror, anxiety, grief, so many different things. But among the straight men who seemed to make a lot of culture at the time, and among women too, a lot of that anxiety went one of two ways. There was a movement in culture called, I think, in Susan Faludi in Backlash calls it the new traditionalism, after a good housekeeping ad campaign that was very much about kind of like the tradwife moment now. It was like, women, go home. You'll be safe there. Make a pie. Be with your family. Don't have affairs. Don't go out and live your free life, because no good can come of that. Movies like Fatal Attraction, where the woman who is, you know, sexually liberated and has a job, she is also crazy and dies. So. You know, not a complex moral message in that. But then on the other hand, you did have this movement of people, and Madonna was one of them. And obviously Madonna lived in New York during the AIDS crisis. She lost a lot of friends to AIDS, Keith Haring among them. She had really seen how it had decimated communities. And she, I think, whether or not it was intentional, but it was very forcefully communicated, she wanted to reclaim sex as something that could be about pleasure and power and joy and meaning again. And so she just made this body of work in the 90s that was incredibly sexually explicit. She made a coffee table book called Sex, succinct title, that was all about renderings of her fantasies. Some of them were kinky, some of them were S&M, some of them were like written poems. Like, it was a lot, but it was very sexually explicit for someone who was as famous as she was, and it was a massive story. And she seemed to be presenting sex as something that people could enjoy voyeuristically. If they were too afraid to have sex, they could watch sex. And so you see a lot of products come along, HBO's Real Sex, documentaries, like there was a more willingness, I think, to engage with sex as a subject in mainstream culture, because it was something that people were so scared of. And so the need to reclaim it, I think, felt very powerful, especially in things like fashion.
Yeah. All the fashion that you talk about is so interesting about then and model culture as well. But now looking back, like looking at kind of current trends, and even in the last 10 years, we saw kind of a rise back to kind of a very girly aesthetic, and mm-hmm. the rise of like Simone Rocha and Molly Goddard and bows and lace and frills. Mm-hmm. And now we're back in bumpster territory. Yeah. It's like, where will it end? I'd love to get to some of your questions now. There have been a lot of great questions submitted. Chloe has asked, you mentioned backlash. Do you think feminism today has lost its punk quality of pushing against the establishment? And how do we avoid that or maintain progress?
That's such a good question. I think feminism has just lost its, like, lost its power, its potency, its kind of relevancy as a cultural idea, even. Like, I do think people who are brave enough to reclaim it, like, a lot, it makes sense that a lot of that energy would come from subcultures, from alternative culture, and that, I think, would cut against what people were so critical of in the mid-2010s in terms of feminism becoming so kind of corporatized and bland and neutered as an ideology. But I just wish people would talk about it again, like, mm-hmm. say the word. I don't know, like, I think we're all aware that things right now are not great for women, that things are going in a dubious direction and trending bad, and there's a lot. We're, you know, really bombarded with news all the time that is terrible, but having the ability to sort of identify things that we want to change is going to be really crucial, I think, and that's certainly a next first step.
We've got a question from Tara. Do you have any advice on writing female characters for fiction with realism, being mindful of how we portray and advocate for young girls becoming women?
Oh, I love that question. I'm not a novelist, so I haven't written female characters, but I've thought a lot about them. And there's a chapter in the book where I get into how part of the reaction against the dehumanization of women in media in the 2000s and this very, excuse me, this very cruel moment of presenting women as like beautiful chaos merchants. There was a real shift in the 2010s towards people, especially women, wanting to write much more complexity in their own lives. And so you see people like Lena Dunham, Emily Gould, like these women who are very vocal about wanting to speak the truth about how they're living and be honest and be messy. And that messiness was really, really thrilling. But for a while, it was also the only kind of portrayal of womanhood that we got in culture. Like the 2010s were really a decade of train wreck. Women, and to the point where I loved shows like Fleabag, and there were so many incredible works of art during that period. But like, you are like, are we ever going to have competence? Like, are we ever going to have like a woman who is actually, you know, she has kids and it's hard and she's a job, but she's, you know, she's making it work. I think there's a little bit more of that now. But it is a difficult question, right? Because you want to be honest and you want to be truthful, and you want to connect with some of the most profound truths of women's lives, but you also, you don't want to kind of limit your imagination in terms of what we're capable of. So advice, no, but do, like, do what you will. I mean, you'll do amazing.
Here is a question that is very of the moment. Persephone has asked, what are your thoughts on Kim Kardashian pushing hairlessness and then selling hair back to us? It's quite amazing that your book tour in Australia has coincided with the rise of Skims Merkins.
Skims Merkins.
Yeah, does it, a sentence I didn't think I would be saying this year. Persephone has asked, does it signify an acceptance of women's body hair? How do these coexist?
No, it doesn't. No, I mean, it's kind of horrifying how successfully Kim is able to make money off of our worst impulses. Like, I'm thinking about the face, like the facelift underwear thing that was like a bra for your face. Yeah. I mean, that was literally a joke in Ally McBeal. I don't know if anyone is old enough to remember Ally McBeal, but I am. No, I mean, it's insane that the woman who, in some ways more than any other woman of our era, has changed the ways in which we think about ourselves and police our own bodies and want the ways in which we want to look and in some ways the meaning of beauty and what it, and has turned it into the most kind of capitalist endeavor. Like, of course she'd try and sell like a pubic hair merkin, like, yeah. But I think what is more astonishing to me is that it sold out. That was really That was really depressing.
I was too late. What a shame.
It's because I bought them all.
Love that you could buy them in all different colours. Yeah. Anyway, another highly voted question was, you said that the 2000s was a period of cultural backlash and culture moves in 20-year cycles. Do you think that we're entering another period of backlash? Example, Ozempic, Bonnie Blue, Roe vs. Wade.
Yeah, I think we're in it. We're deep in it. All the progress that we had made, body positivity gone. It feels destabilizing, I think, to go on the internet and to see the ways that people are talking about women and the ways that they are openly making enormous amounts of money by calling women dumb sluts, like, that it's so overt, that it's a selling point to talk about women that way. Yeah, I think it is. We're profoundly in a moment of backlash. But what that means, I mean, the nice thing about studying the history is every time there's a moment of backlash, it's followed by a moment of progress. And so I do believe that it's coming. I think we're finally now thinking as a culture about what social media is doing to us and realizing that none of it is good. And if we're not fully able yet to sort of reckon with our own relationship with it, we're at least willing to ask questions. And so my hope, just having simply looked at the patterns, is that we will have some kind of momentum in the other direction soon. I don't know when.
Mm. Mel has said that they feel that the word empowerment is often used as a fad today.
Yes.
There's not a real question attached to this. They say that it seems to influence women positively, but it also appears to cater to the male gaze.
Oh, it's a horrible word. Every time it came up in my research, it was being used to defend something that people were angry at, justifiably so. So I think one of the instances, I mean, it's not a horrible word, to be clear, like, women should be empowered. It's more like the ways in which it comes up are always deeply charged, I think. So the Wonder Bra ad from the 1990s, where Eva Herzegova was in a bra and she was saying, like, hello, boys. And it was very, like, old fashioned bombshell. And apparently there were car crashes and stuff. Feminists critiqued that ad and they were told that it was actually empowering because Wonder Bras were empowering because Eva Herzegova felt empowered. There was a movie in the 2000s starring Alicia Cuthbert as a woman who was kidnapped and abused and tortured, and the producers put posters of her all over LA, and somewhere she was bound and somewhere she was, like, bruised on her face. I think in one she was dead, or, you know, perceived to be dead. And people complained about those ads, and they were told that the movie was actually empowering because Alicia Cuthbert's character survives at the end, so it's really like a redemption story. Recently, the CEO of OnlyFans, who's a woman, has been using the word empowering a lot to talk about OnlyFans and how it empowers the women who use it. And I just think whenever anyone uses it, it's a tell almost. They're not, when they're using it that way, they're not interested in really giving women power. They're interested in selling us something. And so, yeah, it's a word I've become very suspicious of when I see it in the wild.
Yeah. Isabel says that they also feel powerless and angry at so much of what's going on in the world, don't we all, and the injustice. What do you do to help feel less angry and powerless?
I do vent a lot of my feelings on the internet. No, I don't know. I mean, I think having the great privilege to come here and do things like this is incredible, because for the last 6 months, I've been in rooms where women have been passionate and engaged and thoughtful and committed and, like, not wanting to take any of this stupid shit anymore. And so there is such a hunger, I think, for anything that can kind of manifest that energy. And any time that we can get together, it doesn't have to be in rooms like this one, but, like, in our small circles, to talk about things, to talk about power, to talk about what we want, like, to imagine what might be a different vision of things and how we could make it happen. Like, that always feels very productive to me, I think.
We'll finish with this question. What can we learn from this period of your research, given the continuation and deepening of the backlash and violence against girls and women? What can we learn? How can we perhaps go forth in a kind of optimistic manner? And I do want to point out that your book does finish with hope.
I think it comes back to what I said earlier, that none of this is inherent to us. None of what we've absorbed from culture is real or true. and the ways in which women every day are writing new versions of the story and new narratives and new power dynamics and new curiosities and are willing to explore things in really thoughtful and sometimes very difficult ways is thrilling to me, because every time someone does that, it gives us a little bit more texture and a little bit more breadth in terms of the project of really understanding ourselves. And so, yeah, just knowing the ways in which we were not propagandized, but like really, really kind of turned against each other. I know it's right there in the title, but like really taught to mistrust and to loathe and to question ourselves. It doesn't have to be that way, and that there is another way of thinking about ourselves and thinking about other women and connecting with other women that is much more hopeful and much more generative.
What a great place to end on. Thank you so much, Sophie. Please join me in thanking Sophie.
Thank you all for coming.
On stage at the Wheeler Centre, Sophie Gilbert. She's an award-winning writer covering pop culture and entertainment with The Atlantic and the author of Girl on Girl, How Pop Culture Turned a Generation of Women Against Themselves, speaking there with Kate Jinks, who is from the Melbourne International Film Festival, which is on each year in August. Find and follow Big Ideas on ABC Listen or wherever you get your pods, and tell your friends about the stuff you hear on the show. And tell us what connects with you. From the Big Thinkers, we bring you the email to get in touch, bigideas@abc.net.au. My name is Natasha Mitchell. I love bringing you big ideas. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.